Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Now at Ohio State, a new podcast featuring researchers, innovators, and bold thinkers who look at our world, see what the real challenges are, and create the solutions that people need now. Available on your favorite podcast platform or visit go.osu.edu/now.
And welcome to All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. Lawmakers in the House voted overwhelmingly last night to suspend the federal debt ceiling for 2 years, doing their part to avoid an economically devastating default. Democrats ultimately delivered more votes for the measure than Republicans did, capping weeks of political wrangling over spending cuts, unspent COVID money, and work requirements for those on food stamps. Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy managed to stop a revolt by hardline members of his party to deliver the bipartisan agreement. It now heads to the Senate, where the pressure is on to take action by Monday. We're talking about national politics today with political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Welcome to All Sides, Ken. Oh, and Ken is muted. Well, yes. Ken, hi.
I was searching for Anne. I couldn't find her. No, I'm sorry. That's not what happened. But hi, Amy. Good morning.
Oh, thank you for being here, Ken. And I apologize for not being Anne, but I'll do my best.
We all love Anne. We miss her. I just wanted to say that because okay, enough of that.
Enough of that. We have to talk about the debt ceiling.
That's right.
Both President Joe Biden and House Speaker McCarthy claimed credit for the compromise that they reached, but who emerged the winner? Is there a winner? Is there a loser? Was it a toss-up?
Well, I would definitely say the American economy is the winner. I really do. I mean, despite the fact that the progressive left and the right-wing right, many of whom were not happy, basically, we couldn't default on our what we owe, and we couldn't allow jobs to fall and people not to get paid and the stock market to crash. So I don't know. I mean, it's one thing to stand on principle. You know, Ronald Reagan once said that I'd rather have 80% of what I want and then rather than, you know, go over the cliff with my flag flying. But I don't think anybody got 80% of what they wanted. But the fact is that President Biden, the clear winner, because, you know, you blame if the economy defaulted, I think most people would blame Biden, even though it was not Biden who was holding up the passing of the debt limit. You know, it was interesting under Donald Trump as president, they passed the debt ceiling. They raised the debt ceiling three times with no complaints from Republicans. But suddenly Republicans seem to be conscious of spending when there's a Democrat in the White House. But the fact is, Kevin McCarthy, even though it could jeopardize his future as Speaker, was a winner. He got a clear majority of his Republicans to vote for it, and Joe Biden the same, with just a handful, actually I should say 46 Democrats who didn't vote for it, but 165 Democrats did vote for it. So Biden gets a big share of the credit as well.
Did you expect the vote to be a little bit closer than that? I mean, it was kind of overwhelming. Yeah.
Oh, I did. Right. Exactly. When you look at it, 314 to 117. I mean, I think this is what one of the reasons people hate politics so much, because here we go again. We're at the cliff. We're about to fall over the cliff. Henny penny, the world is coming to an end. And lo and behold, suddenly the votes are there to keep the economy humming. And we've been threatened with it in the past. The reason we were more scared about it this time is because there are a lot of new Republicans in the House that just don't believe in compromise. They were elected in 2022 and 2020 and 2018, and basically on the argument that politics as usual can't go on, can't continue the way it has been with unlimited spending. Now, as I said, they suddenly noticed that when the Democrats were in the White House. But I expected it to be much closer because I thought there'd be more Republicans to vote against it. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene proudly voted for it. Lauren Boebert suddenly didn't show up after she was telling everybody that everybody has to vote against it. She never even showed up. So
she was busy. God knows, yes.
God knows what that was about. And of course, there were progressives on the left, you know, AOC and people like that voted against it. But for the most part, the center held. And I think that's what the headline is, that yes, McCarthy deserves credit, Biden deserved a lot of credit, but the center held. And we never talk about the center. We never talk about the center in politics anymore. We talk about the far right wing. We talk about the far left wing. And yet there are a lot of centrists. I mean, they're not really centrists, but at least they believe in government working. And you know, sanity won out last night.
Yeah, believing in the government working. Is this the same group of representatives that took 15 times to pick a leader?
Well, you know something. Already one congressman, Doug Bishop, I think it was Doug Bishop, Dan Bishop of North Carolina said he doesn't, he wants a vote. He wants, you know, McCarthy to step down as speaker. But Matt Gaetz said, look, you know, if we wanted a new speaker every time we don't get our way completely, we'd have a new speaker elected every day. So even Matt Gaetz said that's kind of ridiculous to hold McCarthy, you know, to jeopardize McCarthy's future. But clearly, as you pointed out, that he was only elected with such a small majority. You know, there is such a lot of unhappiness, unease in the Republican conference. I should mention that George Santos voted against it. And I think, you know, that almost convinced me to vote against it. But I just realized I'm not a member of Congress, so it didn't matter.
Is George Santos sure he voted against it, or is he still just, you know?
we'll talk about George some other time.
Yeah. So it only takes one person to decide to vote out or have a vote to retain Kevin McCarthy as speaker. Based on this deal, does he hold a seat for a little while?
Well, I think he does. Like, as I say, Dan Bishop said, you know, he called for the removal of McCarthy as speaker, but he didn't use the words motion to vacate. And that's the deal they made when he became speaker, that one single member of the Republican caucus could say, I want a motion to vacate, and then we have to vote for speaker all over again. And Matt Gaetz said, we're not going through that again right now. And Matt Gaetz and, you know, and McCarthy are not good pals at all, shall we say. So for Matt Gaetz to say that McCarthy deserves to stay on, I think he dodges the bullet. He, McCarthy, dodges a bullet right now.
And we're talking about national politics. We're talking about the debt ceiling deal, which made it through the House last night, with political journalist Ken Rudin. I'm Amy Jurevich, and this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. So do you think that this is going to make it through the Senate? Can we do it by Monday?
Yeah, I think it will be maybe today, maybe by tomorrow, well, certainly by Friday. Both leaders of the Senate, Schumer on the Democrats and McConnell for the Republicans, both support the bill. And while there will be, you know, right-wing conservatives on the Senate who may vote no, I was so surprised, I really was, by the size of the margin in the House. I suspect there will be very little, if any, drama in the Senate.
So, well, let's talk about some of the, like, nuances of the bill. Will these come up in the Senate? You know, the work requirements for those on food stamps.
Well, there are a lot of things that dissatisfied both sides. Obviously, the left was not happy about the first of all, they put in a thing that allows more a pipeline to be built because Joe Manchin wanted that. Exactly. The history of politics is, you know, giving a member, a wavering member, some goodies so he can take home to his constituents. And Manchin is up for re-election next year, so he got what he wanted. But the left is not happy about, you know, as you said, the work, increased work requirements for welfare recipients, food stamps, and things like that. They say that's terrible. They're capping future spending, but they didn't cut it as much as many people did, many people expected. But they also, you know, cut billions of dollars out of the IRS. And, you know, everybody's saying that, you know, we need IRS agents because we're too many people are not paying their taxes because the IRS is badly underfunded. But conservatives hate the IRS, so they insisted on the IRS getting, you know, $20 billion or whatever it was, cut after 2 years or 10 years or whatever it was. So not everybody got what they want. I said, you know, the Republicans, conservatives wanted more cuts in spending, things like that. And you know, again, politics should be, it hasn't been lately, but politics should be compromising. And the fact that the right-wingers and the left-wingers are not they're probably more unhappy than happy, and yet an overwhelming majority voted for it. That just says something about the politics. Like, we're not at the end of the world, you know, just yet.
Now, the debt ceiling is arguably, you know, an arguably boring topic, and they've spent weeks and weeks and weeks on it. Now, we know it's important for the economy. We couldn't let the economy collapse, but did it need to take so long to get to this compromise on something like the debt ceiling?
This is what happens with this the politics. Everybody needs to make a speech. Everybody needs to say that we're not compromising. We're not giving in. We're not, you know, we were elected to stand for principle. And everybody says, oh, my God, is my job in jeopardy? Is my stock holdings in jeopardy? What about, you know, all the things that Biden promised, like one of the for example, the cancellation of the student debt? That was taken out as well. So all the things that so many people wanted, but it happens every time. We always get close to the cutoff date, and everybody says, "Oh no! Please save us and rescue us." And then it wasn't even close. So I could see people just being turned off to politics, and they'll say, "Okay, we learned a lesson next time." And there will be a next time, and a next time, and a next time. But the next time we get to this point about a debt ceiling and whether we should, you know, increase it or not, people should say, "Okay, you know, wake me when it's over. Tell me when it's over," because you know it's going to end exactly the same. Of course, maybe when crazy people, there are more and more crazy people in Congress, and they insist on, you know, their way or the highway, and the debt ceiling doesn't get passed, and then we start defaulting, then, my goodness, I mean, I don't know what, I can't imagine what would come next. So somehow we managed to survive, even though the frightening stuff was there, the threats were there, but they're not, they don't feel that they're not there. They don't feel like they're like they're, you know, there right now. Now we can focus on whether, you know, Ron DeSantis was permanently doomed by his Twitter announcement.
Well, we'll get to that. But this deal, this debt ceiling deal, was 2 years. I believe that's probably by design. We
it's
want
two
to get
years,
through the
January of 20. Yeah, January of 2025 is when it expires.
So
the election. After
right.
The election.
So everyone involved maybe agreed. Let's get this done and get it and have it, you know, in hand throughout the election. Don't want to mess up 2024 with this again.
Exactly. And I think everybody benefits for it. For all we know, the people who voted no may be, you know, rounding up more support for their side. But again, if the 2024 election is a referendum on the two parties, what we're seeing right now, the two parties may not look the same. You know, for all we know, the Republicans may not have the House in 2025. The Democrats may not have the Senate in 2025. So, look, the 2024 election is so far away that we can't even start to contemplate what the body will, the House and Senate will look like by then.
Well, let's talk more about 2024. Despite it being far away, it feels like it's right here with these announcements happening every day of the week. So,
it is here because the debates start this summer. I think in August, the Republican debates start, and more candidates are announcing every day. I think you and I may be the only ones who have not announced their candidacy yet. I'm waiting
till next week. That's the better week, right? Next week.
Well, I mean, for example, I mean, if Doug Burgum, the governor of North Dakota, is thinking of running, then my goodness,
yeah,
everybody is running.
Who? Yes. Well,
exactly.
Okay.
Who?
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk all about all those candidates who are throwing their hats in the ring left and right. We are talking about national politics today, and my guest is political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Amy Jurevich, and this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.
And welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The number of Republicans running for president grew by two last week. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis announced his candidacy, as expected, but not the way he intended. Technical difficulties delayed his plan to have a Twitter talk with Elon Musk. That prompted his campaign to release this video instead.
I'm Ron DeSantis, and I'm running for president to lead our great American comeback.
And at a rally in South Carolina, Senator Tim Scott became the first Black candidate in the race, telling his supporters,
"And today, I'm living proof that America is the land of opportunity and not a land of oppression."
But that's not all. Former Vice President Mike Pence and former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie are expected to officially enter the race next week. We are talking about national politics today with political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. And Ken, let's start with that DeSantis announcement. You know, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis took a bit of a fumble with his announcement after touting he would be on Twitter with this audio-only conversation with CEO Elon Musk. What were they thinking?
Well, I mean, you know, it's very funny to me that most of the journalists I've heard, most of the pundits I've heard say that DeSantis, by the way, I never knew it was DeSantis. If you listen to Ron DeSantis talk, he calls himself DeSantis, and we always call him DeSantis. Well, I thought that's kind of interesting. Anyway, I mean, people have been saying that it was a major fumble for the campaign. I don't see it that way. First of all, probably so many people tried to, you know, get on Twitter to listen to it that it just broke the server. And I mean, I buy that completely. And I think that's fine. I think people will keep it as a story for a day or two, and that's the end of it. So was it the way he wanted? No, but there's more problems with Ron DeSantis than just the Twitter launching. I mean, he's not a friendly club, you know, a charming kind of guy. He doesn't lead the league in charisma. He thinks he's kind of like Donald Trump. He's trying to sell himself as Donald Trump without the indictments. But I don't know if every Republican agrees with some of the things like 6 weeks limit until for abortions. I mean, so many women don't know they're pregnant after 6 weeks, you know, and I think there are a lot of women who are saying this is not the party I once knew. But by all accounts, by looking at the polls, DeSantis is clearly the top threat to Donald Trump's, nomination for another term. Now, you can make the case that polls in June of 2023 are probably useless, especially when the caucuses and the primaries don't start for another, you know, at least 6-7 months from now. But it is a little interesting and a little instructive to see that with all the strikes against Donald Trump, with all the investigations and possible future indictments that are, possibly on the way, his numbers really haven't declined. It was close for a while earlier this spring, but then as the indictments came, as more bad headlines came, Trump's numbers went up. So it's almost cult-like. Like, if you're going to criticize my guy, then I'm gonna stand up for him more than ever. And that's, I don't know if the, speaking of going over a cliff, I don't know if Republican voters are bringing their party over the cliff in a rematch against Joe Biden. But right now, I would think that if Biden could beat anybody, well, look, I was about to say if Biden could beat anybody, it's Donald Trump. But we thought that Donald Trump was a sure loser in 2016. And of course, that's not what happened. But anyway, it seems to be, or at least the media is trying to make it a two-way race. And they also say that the more candidates who get in help Trump because, you know, if Trump has a solid 35% of the Republican electorate, then every other candidate will split the anybody but Trump vote. So again, we shouldn't be making predictions right now. We should just observe what we're seeing. And obviously, when the Nikki Haley's and the Tim Scott's and, you know, the Lee Elders and the Vivek Ramaswamy candidates are entering, they obviously feel there's an opening for them. Otherwise, I don't think they would waste their time. But, you know, we'll see.
Do they feel like there's an opening, or they're just trying to get their name out there to become a little more well-known, maybe get a spot somewhere else that they're going for?
Yeah, that's a very, you know, that's a strong possibility, too. I always think of Gary Hart running in 1984, thinking that, you know, he'll get a leg up for 1988. He never expected to do as well as he did. I mean, he easily won the New Hampshire primary. He was a force at the 84 Democratic Convention in San Francisco. So for Gary Hart in 1984, the future, it was now. And that's possible. But, you know, the Nikki Haley's and Tim Scott's, who are both, you know, fascinating candidates. Either they have an inspiring story or they have a good resume. But, you know, it's Donald Trump's to lose. And while I think that everything he does and says helps that cause, you know, the losing cause, even more, voters are clearly, according to polls, don't see it that way.
The number of candidates, I don't know if you watched the TV show Succession. Are you a Succession fan?
I saw it in the beginning. I didn't like any character, so I didn't watch it.
Oh, okay. Well,
I know what happened.
No,
yeah.
Yes, well, no spoilers, but in the final season, one of the sons, Colin, is running for president, and he wants his 1%, his 1% of the vote. And he's holding on to that 1%. So there's some people who will stay in it because they want their 1% of the vote.
Well, but we saw in 2016, you know, there were a whole bunch of Republicans, including Donald Trump, who ran, and then they started dropping out one by one. Once Marco Rubio, once Jeb Bush, once John Kasich, when they went nowhere.
Oh, John Kasich, who? Yeah, remember him?
Yeah, right. John Kasich, of course, wound up voting for Joe Biden, so his future in the Republican Party is over. But obviously the more candidates. Once Super Tuesday was over, you realized that Donald Trump was not going to be stopped. It was not going to be a stop Trump movement at the convention. And that's another thing, you know, when there's a lot of candidates running and you think, wow, Trump is going to be stopped at the convention. That doesn't happen anymore. The conventions don't nominate candidates anymore. It's the primaries. Trump won handily in most of the primaries. And we'll see what happens. Trump says he's not going to be involved. He's not going to join the first, I think it's a Fox News debate in August. And obviously he doesn't want to give the other candidates more attention. At some point he's going to have to join, but maybe he can, you know, he says, why give them any attention when I have all the support I'll need? That could be a premature false theory of his. But again, I think we have a long way to go, but maybe by next February, maybe March, I think the race will be over one way or the other. But I'd like to be proven wrong on that.
So let's talk a little bit about Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, and then also from South Carolina, Nikki Haley, the only woman in the race right now, is, you know, their state is an early primary state, but will they cancel each other out?
Well, that's what I was thinking. Of course, the Democrats, I mean, Joe Biden is not going to have any problem getting renominated if he does run. Can I just say, can I throw out a theory that I've been thinking about lately?
Oh, please do.
I didn't think he was going to run. I thought because he's 80 years old, he'll be 107 by the end of his term. You know, there's an age thing, blah, blah, blah. But he had to say he was running. Otherwise, he would be a lame duck and would have no influence in like a debt ceiling fight. I'm still not convinced he's going to be the nominee. I could be wrong, and I'm often wrong. And there's also a lot of talk about Kamala Harris. Now, I can't imagine Joe Biden dropping Kamala Harris. He could do what Adlai Stevenson did in 1956 and throw open the choice of a running mate to the convention, which Stevenson did, and the delegates picked Estes Kefauver over John F. Kennedy and people like that. But she's already the vice president. If you're going to tell the first African-American woman, the first African-American and the first woman vice president that they're dumped from the ticket, I think black voters will just say, okay, I've had enough of Joe Biden. Let's just say, boy, that was a long parenthetical. Let's just say it is a Biden-Harris ticket. You know, there's, you know, it's, I think he's certainly beatable. And I kind of suspect that he would be beatable by a younger candidate. And so when you have the Tim Scotts, oh, my point of this, eventually, yes. I just remember what my point was. The point is the Democratic Party is having South Carolina the first contest. Now, of course, there's not going to be primaries because Joe Biden is not, you know, the only people running against him is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's running on a very bizarre set of issues, and Marianne Williamson, the guru of something or other. But for the Republicans, it's still Iowa first, then New Hampshire, then Nevada, then South Carolina. Nikki Haley probably thought she had New Hampshire, Nevada to, sorry, South Carolina to herself. She, in fact, appointed Tim Scott to the Senate when there was a vacancy, and they do get along. But Tim Scott obviously thought, well, if Nikki Haley could run, why can't I? And they both have interesting things in their background that could boost them. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, look, Walter Mondale was supposed to run away with the Democratic nomination in 1984. And this new candidate, Gary Hart, came in and made it very, very close. Again, we need to see if any of these candidates will rival Trump or DeSantis when we get closer and closer to the actual voting.
Now, isn't a part of the reason Biden threw his hat in the ring was not just so he wouldn't be a lame duck, but also it's believed like he can beat Trump. But if you have Kamala Harris running, she can't. She can't beat Trump.
Well, no. And I don't think if Biden were running, I don't think Kamala Harris would get the nomination. I kind of think that Trump may be the only person Biden can beat. But I won't even bother giving that prediction because, you know, the day of the election in 2016, I thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. So it makes no sense and it benefits nobody to give prediction down the line. But to me, it just seems like there are so many things against Trump, especially if what happens in the Atlanta investigation, what happens in the Justice Department investigation. I mean, you know, it's one thing Stormy Daniels and E. Jean Carroll are bad enough, but when it comes to, you know, plotting to overthrow the government or inciting January 6th, which clearly in my view happened, Trump may realize that you know, June or May of 2023 was his high point, and he'll only go down from there. We'll see.
Well, speaking of January 6th, let's talk about former Vice President Mike Pence, who is expected to launch his presidential bid next week in Iowa. So an Iowa poll found that Pence was viewed favorably by 66% of Iowans. But in June of 2020, which is a lifetime ago, 86% of people liked him. So what do you think? Is he a middle of the pack kind of candidate, or will he just do OK in Iowa and then disappear?
I don't. He's strong with evangelicals. We know that. We know that the evangelical community loved when Trump picked Pence as his running mate in 2016, and probably that's one of the main reasons they stayed with him. Now, I'm not going to dismiss the evangelical vote at all. Iowa is interesting, but it's hardly not definitive. I mean, let me tell you, give you a list of some of the Republicans who won the Iowa caucuses. Ted Cruz in 2016, Rick Santorum in 2012, Mike Huckabee in 2008. I mean, in 2008, John McCain, who got the nomination, finished fourth in Iowa. So, and George H.W. Bush, when he ran in 1988 and Bob Dole won Iowa, George W. Bush finished third after Pat Robertson. My only point is, you know, you could try to out-evangelicize. I know that's not a word, and it's probably not even close to a word, but that doesn't mean you get the nomination. And I don't know, poor Mike Pence. I mean, you know, he could just stand up and say that what Donald Trump tried to do was unconstitutional, but he's so delicate when it comes to Trump. He's so afraid of offending him as much, even though Trump supporters said, you know, said, let's hang Mike Pence. And Trump himself has said that he's such a disappointment. But Pence doesn't seem to have the... You got to stand for something. And I know he, you know, he's always, I think he said that he believes in faith, family, and party in that order. So I know there's no question about his beliefs as far as religious beliefs, but I think politically he's just, I'm surprised that you said he's likely to announce next week, because I spoke to somebody who knows him kind of well and said they still haven't made a decision yet. So my information could be old, but I just don't think he doesn't have a kind of a shot that, well, I don't think Chris Christie has a shot either. I think, you know, I don't think an anti Trump candidate.
Well, I think I'm sorry. Chris Christie, the former New Jersey governor, he branded himself as the only Republican willing and able to take down former President Trump. And he's expected to enter the race next week in New Hampshire. So,
but he was a Trump enabler for a long time until after January 6th. I mean, same with Nikki Haley. Nikki Haley could talk about being a independent, but she was a Trump person and she was anti-Trump in 2016. But once he was elected, she was a Trumpster. So, you know, if voters are looking for somebody who's really separate from Trump, who never just joined the bandwagon, then you might look at Chris Sununu, the governor of New Hampshire, but I don't think he's going to run either. Which you know what that means? It means that Doug Burgum of North Dakota will be the nominee. Huh. I just figured that out right now.
Well, there you go. That, you know,
yeah. You heard it here last.
You heard it here first. So, do you think that, you know, I mean, it is starting to remind us a little of 2016 all over again, lots of candidates all canceling each other out. Is Donald Trump just going to sit back and be like, yep, join the party, well, as many as possible?
He's actually, there was an article about that the other day, and I forgot where I read it, but he said that he said he really likes Tim Scott. He had no problem with Nikki Haley getting in the race. And that goes back to the theory that the more the merrier for Donald Trump. But it's just hard to just imagine anybody, you know, other than DeSantis winning the nomination over him, because there's so, you know, there's Trump and there's 30 points back is DeSantis and then a million points back is everybody else. Again, this is June 1st. And, you know, we'll see what happens after the debate, after Iowa, New Hampshire. It's very possible we'll have a completely different picture. But the snapshot right now, it's Trump's nomination to lose, and DeSantis has the best shot of overtaking him, you know.
This is All Sides, and I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We are talking today with political journalist Ken Rudin, the host of the Political Junkie podcast. We have much more to talk about. We're going to get into Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. We'll also talk about California Senator Dianne Feinstein, and we'll be back right after this break. This is 89.7 NPR News.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. New data shows that Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas no longer holds favor with the public that he once did. An 11-point negative image rating puts him just below Justice Brett Kavanaugh, the previously least popular justice. Thomas's overall ratings drop is the largest of any justice and comes following news stories of detailing his lavish gifts and vacations he accepted from a billionaire benefactor. We're talking about politics this hour, national politics, with political journalist Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. So, Ken, Thanks for being here. And what does a favorability rating for Justice Clarence Thomas, that was reported in the Washington Post last week, what does it tell you about how much the public pays attention to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, it clearly does. I mean, not since the controversial decision, the 5-4 decision in 2000 that made George W. Bush the president over Al Gore, has the Supreme Court come under such controversy. And it's amazing that if the media were not reporting what all these gifts and expenses that were being paid for Clarence Thomas, nobody would care about it, but they seem to do care about it. The only problem is the only people who can decide the future of the Supreme Court is the Supreme Court. John Roberts, I would imagine, is completely unhappy with all these bits of information coming out about who, you know, the payments to Thomas. But he's not breaking any law. There's a code of conduct that they all sign, but I don't know, you know, not since Abe Fortas in 1969, when even this was Lyndon Johnson's nominee in 1969, even the Democrats, even Chief Justice Earl Warren, said because of these conflicts of interest and these payments to a swindler, you know, kind of guy, it was time for Fortas to step down, and he did. But no conservative is telling Fortas, is telling Clarence Thomas to quit. And you know, I mean, of course, Congress could impeach him. And as a matter of fact, I remember back in the day when Gerald Ford, who was the minority leader in the House, wanted to impeach William O. Douglas, who was one of the more liberal members of the Supreme Court, and that went absolutely nowhere. The fact is, look, you know, Clarence Thomas could have zero approval ratings, but he's given no indication at all that he's going to step down. He has given no indication that he cares what anybody thinks about it. And that goes for Ginni Thomas, too, his wife, who, I mean, the fact that she's lobbying for issues that come before the court, and nobody thinks that's a conflict of interest at all, and nobody thinks that Thomas should recuse himself from some issues, is just remarkable. But this is what politics is now. You do what you want. You say what you want, and if there's consequences, but so far there aren't consequences, you keep doing it. It's a very sad situation, and I think the polling indicates that.
And we have a caller, Mark from Columbus, wants to weigh in on Clarence Thomas. And go ahead, Mark, you're on the air. You're on All Sides with Ken Rudin. Mark, are you there? Hey, Mark, we didn't have you. Start over again there, Mark.
Okay. Thank you for allowing me to call in. I take an offense to the news organizations picking on Clarence Thomas as if no other justice takes trips. And if you go to opensecrets.com, you'll read that they've been following the trips that justice takes since about 2014. Ruth Bader Ginsburg took them. Breyer took more trips in 1 year than Thomas did. He's now retired. But all the justices take trips that are paid for by other people. When they do speaking engagements, they aren't going to pay for that out of their salary, which is only about $150,000 a year. They all take rides on planes to go to a university and whatever. So whenever a news organization picks on just Thomas, I think it's a political campaign to discredit the Supreme Court, and that's all it is. I think it's very, very unfair.
All right. Thank you for that call, Mark. So what do you think, Ken? Do all justices break these non-existent ethics rules?
Many do, and I'll tell you, I'll agree with Mark about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She did accept trips. She did accept speaking engagements, things that she shouldn't have done. She said that if Donald Trump is elected, I'll leave the country. A Supreme Court justice should not be doing that. There are a lot of things that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is sainted by the left, I understand that, but a lot of things she said and did that should not have been just allowed. But I think Thomas has come down on with everything, with all these constant trips, and his nephew is being paid, and the rent is being paid to a family member. And as one person who's paying all this money, who obviously has issues before the court, they may not be direct issues, but I think to say that the attacks on Clarence Thomas is because the left, you know, because he's too conservative, or it's left wing bias, and the liberal justices have gotten away with it. I don't think that's fair at all. I think what Thomas has done is beyond is the right word. It's I don't think it's corruption per se, but I do think it's unethical. And yes, other justices did it, and yes, Ruth Bader Ginsburg did a lot of things that I think she shouldn't have done according to ethics rules. But I really think that Clarence Thomas has done so many things, accepted so many favors by this one multimillionaire Republican businessman that really John Roberts should put his foot down if he has any influence in the court anymore. It doesn't seem like that's the case, by the way.
Well, June is a busy month for the court, and with rulings expected on a number of high-interest issues. But last week, the court narrowed the scope of the Clean Water Act, and Brett Kavanaugh voted with the more liberal justices. Did that surprise you?
It does. I mean, there are sometimes he'll do some things that will surprise me. Anthony Kennedy, who used to be the Supreme Court, the swing vote on the Supreme Court, who was very conservative, sometimes, maybe even often, would vote with the left on some issues that would surprise me. Yeah, that is the case. I think there's at least another, now I'm forgetting his name, but the first justice that Donald Trump named to the court also will sometimes vote with the liberals. But the fact is that this court, this session, will always be remembered as the overturning of Roe. And I think the American people made it clear how they feel about that by the re-election results in 2022, when the issue of choice, reproductive rights, and things like that were overwhelmingly, the voters overwhelmingly came out and said that the court was wrong. So I know this is the kind of issue that helps Republicans in primaries. I know that abortion is strongly felt by both sides, and they always have been. But I think 2022 was the first time I ever saw a reaction to anti-choice decisions by the court where voters came out. And then we see that in states around the country, in Kansas, in Kentucky, in Indiana, in Vermont, a lot of when it's on the ballot. And we'll see if it gets on the ballot in Ohio, because they're trying to raise the bar to pass anything in Ohio. But if it passes in Ohio too, which is a conservative state, they should realize that abortion is not a simple liberal conservative issue. It's it's a right that's been there for 50 years, and it was suddenly taken away from them.
Well, let's spend a few minutes talking about California Senator Dianne Feinstein. At age 89, she returned to D.C. to vote for judicial nominations. And a story in the New York Times chronicled just how many aides she needs to complete her work. So her vote on the Senate Judiciary Committee is key to moving judicial nominations forward. But what do you think of her decision to stay, to be there in D.C., to come in and vote?
If you're a Democrat, you desperately want, just like you wanted to will Ruth Bader Ginsburg to stay alive through the end of the Trump administration. She couldn't do that. She passed away in September of 2020, and Trump was allowed to name his third Supreme Court justice. Democrats desperately need Dianne Feinstein to stay healthy, stay alive, at least to keep coming to the Senate. And the reason is, if she resigned, right now, the Judiciary Committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, is 11 Democrats, 10 Republicans. When she was gone for several months because of shingles and other issues, it was 10-10, and Democrats could not forward President Biden's judicial nominations. They couldn't at all. So they had to wait for her to come back. So with her back in the Senate, with her back with an 11-10 vote, her vote allows Biden judiciary nominations to move on to the full Senate. The fact is, though, is that is she making her decisions? Is she really alert and aware? And that's a serious and valid question. I remember in 1969, Carl Mundt, the Republican senator from South Dakota, suffered a stroke and he never showed up again. And his term ended in 1972. 3 years later, he just never showed up again. But nobody seemed to get, you know, go crazy over it because the Democrats had such a big lead, a majority in the Senate. It didn't matter. Here it's 11-10 on the Judiciary Committee. It's 51-49 in the full Senate. Every vote counts. And you know, they used to say that about Strom Thurmond, that he would be wheeled in by his aides and he would vote the way he was told. But I think it's even worse with Dianne Feinstein. She has a tremendous legacy in her years in this, not only in the Senate since 1992, but of course as mayor of San Francisco, and of course coming to that office is such sad occurrences. You know, the murders of Mayor George Moscone and Harvey Milk. But she has a great legacy, a great resume. It's so sad that it's very possible we'll remember Dianne Feinstein as somebody who just lost her faculties, and that's what it seems to be. She doesn't seem to always know or ever know where she is, and her staff is doing whatever they can to protect her as well as protecting the Democrats' 11-10 majority in the Senate. You know, so, you could say the Republicans, well, if she resigns and Gavin Newsom names a replacement, why won't you, you know, let that replacement replace Dianne Feinstein? But the Republicans will never do that. So the Democrats have to hope that she stays alive, or at least serving in the Senate through January of 2025.
So what do you mean? Gavin Newsom can appoint someone, but the Republicans can not let the person in? How does that work?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, of course, if just like when, I'm just trying to think, when Pete Wilson, no, forget about that. I don't want to go into obscure history. But of course, Gavin Newsom, if there's a vacancy in the Senate, as most governors can do, they can name a successor. And that successor, male or female, although Gavin Newsom says he would name a Black woman to the Senate. That would be interesting if that happened, if there were a vacancy. Now, that person would serve in the Senate, but to serve on a committee, if one person of the committee objects, then the committee votes for it, and I think you have to have 60 votes. I should know that, but the fact is the Republicans can block any attempt to replace Feinstein on the committee with a vote.
So it doesn't have to deal with her leadership role on the committee. It's just on the committee in general.
Oh, on the committee. Matter of fact, she really doesn't have a leadership. She would have been the Senate President Pro Tem, you know, the senior member of the majority party in the Senate, but she gave it up. She gave it up, I think, to Patty Murray. And the reason she gave it up is because she knew that she's not fit for that, you know, that kind of a position, third in line for the presidency.
So let's talk about this fit situation, because age is just a number. You know, you have President Biden at 80, you have Donald Trump, who's just a few years younger, Dianne Feinstein at 89. Should there be a number on, like, you know, an age limit, or should it just be more like, are they supposed to give them some sort of test to see if they can stay in, like having to redo your driver's test?
That's a fair question, and I know we're not talking about being ageist here. I mean, you could be, you know, you could be old at 40 and young at 70. I understand that, but you know, it's interesting that all the Republicans say Joe Biden is too old to be president, and then they go to Iowa and try to get the endorsement from 89-year-old Senator Chuck Grassley. I mean, you know, that's kind of ridiculous. But Chuck Grassley is also 89, a few months younger than Dianne Feinstein, but he is clearly more alert, clearly more with it, you know, the way Chuck Grassley has always been, for better or worse, than Dianne Feinstein. I don't think it's the age that's hurting her as much as it is her health and her condition. And that is, you know, in any other situation, if the Republicans had a big lead in the Senate or the Democrats had a big lead in the Senate, there would be no hesitancy in forcing or persuading Feinstein to resign. But right now, if the Democrats had her resign, they would live to rue the day because she's the only one who can keep Biden's judicial nominees continuing for a Senate vote.
All right. Well, Ken Rudin, political journalist and host of the Political Junkie podcast, thanks so much for joining us today for this discussion of national politics. We really appreciate your time.
Amy, I love being on with you. You're great today, and I'm good luck with everything.
All right. Well, thank you. And this is All Sides, and I'm Amy Jurevich, and this is 89.7 NPR News.